Welcome to Wall Street Unspun with your host, Peter Schiff.
But it's a giant bubble in search of a pin, and it's going to find
one. Are you confused with the ups and downs of the economy and what it means to you?
Don't believe the propaganda, and that's what it is. When you're listening to an analyst on a lot of these popular financial shows, you're not getting investment advice. You're getting propaganda.
Get ready to untangle the web of misinformation provided by the mainstream media.
These firms are trying to sell you stocks. Their real clients, their banking clients, are trying to get rid of stocks.
And now, here's your host of Wall Street Unspun, the president of Euro Pacific Capital and a licensed broker with a passion for truth. It's Wall Street Unspun with Peter Schiff.
Hi, everybody. Welcome again to another live edition of Wall Street Unspun. This is Peter Schiff, host of the show, president of Euro Pacific Capital, author of Crash Proof, How to Profit from the Coming Economic Collapse. I'm taking your calls live at 888-678-9597, 888-678-9597. We're broadcasting on my website at www.europac.net and also on shortwave radio 5.07 megahertz as I do every Wednesday evening live at 8 p.m. Pacific time, 5 p.m. Eastern, or rather 8 p.m. Eastern time, 5 p.m. Pacific time, and this is Wednesday, June 24th, 2009. First of all, last week I wasn't able to do the show. I hope my brother Andrew did a good job in my absence. Actually, I was at a dinner, and I got to meet for the first time Muriel Rubini, who was the economic professor who kind of stole my Dr. Doom title when Time Magazine wrote a piece, or The New Yorker, whatever, labeling him Dr. Doom. Of course, CNBC started calling me Dr. Doom in 2005, and I kind of, kept that title. Although now there are quite a few Dr. Dooms out there, so I'm one of many. In fact, sometimes it's hard to throw a stick without hitting a Dr. Doom. But I enjoyed meeting him, and he's an interesting guy, very, very bright. We agree on almost everything, and so there's only a few points that we tend to disagree with. But overall, on the big picture, long-term, we're pretty much on the same page. On just about everything. But I thought it's interesting that all this time I'd never actually met the guy, although we do seem to speak at similar events. He's certainly held in higher regard, I think, by the mainstream now. I think maybe because of his credentials being an actual economics professor, whereas I am not a professional economist. I just am a economist by a self proclaimed calling myself an economist. But also, he does support the stimuluses and the bailouts, although privately he's actually doesn't support them nearly as much as he appears to support them in public. So I wasn't really sure about that, because I was expecting to argue with him about the bailouts and the stimuluses, and privately he more or less agreed with my criticism of them. So I was a little bit surprised by that, but it was a pleasant surprise because it was always my opinion that he was a stronger supporter of those programs. Anyway, speaking about programs, I will be on Glenn Beck, unless, of course, they last-minute cancel it. You never know. I mean, they've done that to me before. But I'm going to be on the Glenn Beck Show tomorrow night on Fox News. It's 5 p.m. Eastern Time. It's a live show. I will be in studio with Glenn. I'm not really sure what we're going to talk about, but I'm glad to be back on his show. Of course, I used to do the show, far more often when he was back on Headline News. I used to do it sometimes two or three times a week. But at least I'm back on the show now after several months of not being on it. I was on it, not too long ago. Also, my brother was on Fox Business the other day. It was his debut on television, talking on behalf of Euro Pacific Capital. I think he did a pretty good job. You can see his interview on my website under video interviews. I think the only thing I think I maybe disagree with at the end, I think he got caught off guard with respect to gold. He was asked a question about the premiums in gold, and I think inadvertently, ended up agreeing that the Perth Mint, you end up paying a big premium when you don't. I mean, he mentioned that we work with these certificates without mentioning them by name. But the premium in gold has been when you buy coins, and there's been a shortage of coins because the mints haven't been fabricating enough of the small denomination coins, so they've been trading at a premium. One of the reasons that we buy gold at the Perth Mint is because we want to avoid that premium. And, of course, we want to have our gold outside the United States because of the increasing political risk in this country and the increasing likelihood that gold will end up being confiscated one day. And I think the odds of your gold being seized from you are less if the gold is not in the United States. But anyway, I thought he did a pretty good job overall, and hopefully he'll be on more shows. It's interesting, too, on this topic that, I'm still hardly ever on. I mean, I was on. If you go on my website at Europac and you look at video interviews, I have a listing of the shows that I was on, and you can go back and you can see, the frequency. I was on CNBC on June 8th, and then I was on in May 22nd. So there's a pretty good back. And then before that, I was on May 4th. I wasn't on. There's big gaps. I mean, Fox News, I'm barely on. CNN, God, I haven't been on. I was on CNN on April 24th, and then May 18th, and that's it for the. And then I was on March 3rd. I mean, barely. I was on January 10th, four times this year. I was on Bloomberg. I was on Bloomberg Television in January. I haven't been on since. I mean, that's once this year on Bloomberg. I used to do these shows all the time. And, they mainly called me. I didn't call them. And it's interesting, and I've pointed this out before, but in the past, when I was making all my gloom and doom forecasts, they called me all the time. Now that a lot of those forecasts have come true, they barely ever call me. And you would think that, my profile would have been elevated, considering that just about everybody else got it wrong. You'd figure that they'd want to hear from the guy that got it right more often, but it's actually the reverse. They don't want to be reminded that I got it right, despite the fact that I don't even throw it in their face. I mean, I seldom say I told you so. I'm generally very gracious when I'm on the shows, particularly when I'm on the shows with people who were very critical of me in the past. I rarely remind them of that fact unless they really, really get ridiculous, and then I sometimes bring it up, but it's generally in response to their attacks on me. And it was interesting, I was watching today because on David Faber, who I think is a good guy, and he came out with a book, and it's probably a good book. I haven't read it, called The Roof Caved In. But you would think he wrote the book, The Roof's Gonna Cave In, and came out with it 2 or 3 years ago, the way everybody is fawning all over him on CNBC about how great this book is. Meanwhile, I wrote a book predicting the meltdown, and I'm sure there's not much substantive information in this book written after the fact that I didn't already write about in my book or in my numerous commentaries over the years that I emailed to many, many people at CNBC, probably including David Faber and Joe Kernan, who was interviewing him today, talking about how great the book was. I definitely was sending Joe all these emails, and pretty much all the stuff that was in his book about the problems in the mortgage market, about the conflict of interests, about the phony appraisals, about the underwriting standards, about the moral hazard, about the impending bankruptcy of Freddie and Fannie, about how bogus the ratings agencies were, about how the securitization was a fraud, about how everything was going to collapse, about how it was going to impact the financials, how it was going to impact the economy. I was sending these commentaries for years to these guys, and they ignored them. They had all the information to write that book before the fact, but they didn't do it. And, of course, now, and it's not just him. I mean, you go to Amazon now and you look at the top titles. There's title after title after title about the economic collapse, about the meltdown, about all the things that have happened. But, before it happened, there were very few books out there. I mean, there were some kind of books. And, I get the criticism. People say, well, you're gloom and doom. I mean, if you're always predicting gloom and doom, eventually you're going to be right. But if you actually read what I wrote in Crash Proof and you read what I wrote in my commentaries, and if you go to the Euro Pacific Capital website, and you can go to my commentary archives, it's under resources, or just click on the most recent commentary, and it brings you to the link for the archives. Go back and read my commentaries from 2004 and 2005 and 2006. particularly, I don't have them organized by category, but there's at least a dozen of them specifically on real estate and what was going to happen and how the recession was going to start. It wasn't me just, you know, saying gloom and doom. I laid out exactly why we were in trouble and what the reasons for it and how it was going to play out. So, you know, I got all the pieces correctly. It wasn't just that I'm screaming, you know, gloom and doom, collapse, and it happened. I laid out precisely why it was going to happen. And especially if you haven't seen this, I mentioned this before, but it still amazes me that more people haven't looked at it. If you go on YouTube or on my website, and you go to, you know, Peter Schiff Mortgage Bankers, look at that speech that I gave in front of the Western Regional Mortgage Bankers Association, particularly if you look at clips 4, 5, and 6, which are specific to real estate market and real estate finance. I'm sure there's nothing in Faber's book substantively that is not addressed by me in that speech from 2006. And, you know, it's a lot harder, I guess, to have foresight than hindsight. And to me, you know, it seems that these guys on CNBC, rather than congratulating Faber for his hindsight, you know, you think one of them would have congratulated me for my foresight, but that hasn't happened yet. Anyway, getting to the markets, the dollar to me looks extremely vulnerable. The dollar index rose today. The dollar index is back above 80, but it's been trading above and below 80, but in a very configuration, and it looks to me that it's more likely to break to the downside than to the upside. And as far as the short-term movement in the stock market, short-term, I can make a case for stocks going either way in the short run. I mean, both U.S. stocks and foreign markets, we've had a bit of a move down recently. Whether this is the end of it and we're going to continue the explosive rally that we've had over the past few months, or we're going to have a more meaningful decline, I can't tell. It's always difficult to guess short-term. But I think the direction of the dollar, to me, it looks far more likely that the dollar will fall than rise, regardless of what happens in the market. And that would be the opposite of what happened in late 2008 when you had the markets down and the dollar up, because that combination exacerbated the declines in foreign stocks relative to declines in U.S. stocks. If I'm right on the short-term movement of the dollar, even if U.S. markets, foreign markets, all markets are weak, a weak dollar will lessen the severity of the decline abroad from a dollar perspective. And, of course, if the markets rally, I still think the dollar is going to be weak. I think the dollar is going to be weak either way. So I think either way, if the markets go up, foreign markets will go up more. And if the markets go down, foreign markets will go down less. And ultimately, I think you're going to see more and more of this decoupling, because I still think that the economic data coming out from a lot of countries is not nearly as weak as people feared. Of course, we still have foreign central banks coming to our rescue, unfortunately, because what we need is for foreign central banks to get out of the way so that Washington is forced to make some tough choices. Right now, they're able to avoid those tough choices because they can borrow more money. But the five-year auctions that we had today, 63% of the auction was taken up by foreign central banks. I mean, that's huge, right? I mean, that's, you know, over 60% of the bonds that we sold. And, of course, you know, there were also bonds bought by foreign institutions, I'm sure, that were not central banks. So I'm sure that we relied on, you know, over 70% of our borrowing must have come from abroad, probably a lot more, maybe 80% between foreign companies and foreign central banks. And if we're going to be borrowing, you know, $3 trillion over the next year, which we're scheduled to do, you know, that means better than $2 trillion of that is going to be coming from abroad. I mean, that is enormous. That's a huge external drain on America for generations to come. I mean, if we keep this up over the entire Obama term, you know, we'd be borrowing in excess of $10 trillion from foreigners. I mean, if interest rates, you know, went to 10%, that would be an extra $1 trillion a year in interest payments that we'd be obligated to make to foreign creditors on top of whatever interest that we have, payments we have to make based on the debt they already own. I mean, that would be an intolerable burden if we actually intended to honor our commitments, which of course we don't. As I've said many times, we are going to default. We'll either do it honestly and we won't pay, or we'll do it dishonestly by printing money. But either way, our creditors are going to get screwed, which of course is the reason that they're going to stop lending us money. I just wish they would do it sooner rather than later, because everybody is made worse off. The more money the world lends us, the more money the world's going to lose. And the bigger our government's going to get, the more out of balance our economy is going to grow, the deeper into debt we're going to grow. And so the worse it's going to be for us when they finally come to their senses. So the sooner they come to their senses, the better. You know, the Fed came out today with its much-anticipated statement, and they addressed the market's concerns that they might hike interest rates because of rising long-term bonds or inflation fears or the economic recovery that everybody thinks is coming, which isn't. And the Fed basically assured everybody that interest rates will not rise anytime soon, that they will stay at zero for the foreseeable future. Simultaneously, I guess some people got excited because the Fed did not say that they were going to be buying any particular quantity of government bonds, because, of course, the Fed's been denying that they would monetize the debt. And so they don't want to give a clear signal that they're intending to monetize. But, of course, that's what they're doing. The only way they can maintain interest rates at artificially low levels is to buy the debt, unless the foreign central banks keep buying it all, then it's foreigners who are monetizing our debt for us and creating inflation abroad and, you know, screwing their own citizens, which ultimately they need to stop doing. But basically the Fed is talking out of both sides of its mouth. They're just basically saying what they think the markets want to hear, because the whole thing is a propaganda effort. And everybody keeps talking about the Fed's exit strategy. They have no exit strategy. There is no exit from this. They want to pretend there's an exit strategy. But it's impossible, because if the Fed would be willing to swallow the tough medicine, or make us swallow the tough medicine that would be required when they exit the stimulus, they would do that right now. Because unfortunately, the longer they stimulate the economy, the more painful the exit strategy. So if we're going to exit from this nonsense, we should do it right now. Because if we do it a year from now, it's going to be much more painful. And if they won't do it now because they're afraid of the pain, why would they do it a year from now? You know, all these green shoots that everybody is talking about, and, you know, it's the only thing we're getting, the positive signs that people think they see in the economy. I mean, we have to get something for trillions of dollars of stimulus. The government's buying some time. The problem is the consequence. The problem is what happens when the stimulus wears off and we get a hangover from the overdose. Again, remember that when Bush and Greenspan stimulated the economy after the dot-com crash in September 11th, we did get 4 or 5 years of phony prosperity. You know, we had green shoots that became tall trees. They ultimately collapsed on us because the whole thing was phony. And the pain that we're experiencing now is a direct consequence of the phony growth that we got from the stimulus. So we're getting more of that now. We're obviously getting some artificial boost from all this stimulus. The amazing thing is the boost is so small, given the enormity of the stimulus. And, of course, the come down, the collapse from this stimulus is going to be much worse than what happened thus far from the last stimulus. Anyway, a couple of things I wanted to talk about before I grab the phones. And also I realized, you know, I recorded another video blog today, and a lot of the stuff I'm talking about now I also address in my video blog. If you're not watching the video blog, I'm trying to do them every day, although many times I don't get around to it, but I did do one the last couple of days. And, I don't know, not as many people as I thought are watching these things. I know on my own site I've got about 2,000 subscribers to the Schiff Report on YouTube. Also, a number of people have subscribed through my website, and we simply mail them the links through the Europac site. And a number of people watch these videos through various other websites that are copying them and putting them up there. But I still think a lot more people need to be watching these. So if you're not watching them, make a point that I am putting these things up on my website, up on YouTube, and tell other people about them. Send them around, spread the word, because, you know, I'm trying to educate people as to what's really going on in the economy, in the markets, and the news that people get from conventional sources is just not adequate. And I think, you know, what I'm able to pack into a 10-minute blog, video blog, I think is a lot better than what people are getting through other sources. I also talked on that blog today about the president's health care plan, and, you know, the guy actually had the gall or the chutzpah to make a speech, and basically he defended this plan by attacking his critics, but attacking it through the construction again of a straw man, and then he tears down that straw man. Basically, there's been some criticism from the private sector and from the Republicans that if the government sets up its own insurance program and offers health insurance, that the market will not be able to compete, and that private health insurance companies might actually go out of business because they couldn't compete with a government-provided insurance plan. Now, of course, what Barack Obama has twisted that into meaning is that the private sector is afraid of how efficient and how good the government plan is going to be. They're saying, wait a minute, the Republicans say the government can't do anything right. Why are they so afraid that if the government gets into health care, they're going to offer such a competitive product that the free market can't compete? Well, that's not the problem. The problem isn't that the government is going to offer health insurance efficiently. It's going to do it inefficiently. But the inefficiencies will be subsidized by taxpayers. So what's going to happen is you're going to have a government-created insurance company that's going to be able to write insurance policies without any regards to the actuality soundness of these policies. They're not going to have to price the policies to reflect the risks. And they're not going to have adequate reserves to fund them, because the government doesn't have to account for its unfunded liabilities like a private sector insurance company would. So what can happen is the government can give out policies where the costs are lower and the benefits are richer than what a for-profit private sector company could do when it was bound by actual laws and it had to be a sound enterprise. The government can write policies that will produce losses, because if the private sector wrote policies that would produce losses, they'd go out of business. And they can't do that. They need to stay in business. They need to be profitable. They need to pay dividends to the shareholders. So they have to do things economically and soundly and efficiently, which is what we want. But the government-run insurance company, they don't have to worry about going bankrupt. They can lose money forever, you know, like the post office or like Amtrak. So what's going to happen is the insurance is going to be low cost, so people will sign up for it. And those people are going to come out of the private sector, so the private sector companies are going to lose business to the government insurance companies, but it's not going to be because insurance is going to be provided at a lower cost. It's going to be provided at a higher cost, because the money you save by getting cheap government health insurance will be more than offset by the extra cost of higher taxes or higher inflation that we're going to have to pay to subsidize the enormous losses that a government-run insurance program is certainly going to accumulate. So the net effect is going to be that health insurance is much more expensive provides it than when the private sector provides it, because it's not simply the cost of the insurance, but the added taxes and inflation that are going to be necessary to subsidize the losses. What people have to remember, Barack Obama is talking about, we want to bring down health care costs. Well, there's only one way to bring down health care costs, and that's to introduce free market principles that have been kept out. That's what we need. Free markets drive costs down and drive quality up. That's why they're great. That's why we're a capitalistic country, precisely because markets drive down prices, drive down costs, and drive up quality. That's how competition works. That's how market forces work. On the other hand, government intervention drives down quality and drives up cost. And so the solution to our health insurance problems is not to get even more government involvement, but we need less government involvement. We need to put the market back in charge and take control away from the government. Of course, Barack Obama's plan is the exact opposite of that. And you know, he was able to raise his straw man. And I didn't see any real criticism of that in the conventional media, and it really was a layup. And it's too bad that more people didn't call him on the absurdity of the position that he was taking. Anyway, let me quickly go to the phones. First one up from Mexico. Let me take John down in Cancun. How are you, John?
Hi, Peter. It's an honor to speak to you. Can you hear me okay?
Loud and clear.
Great. I'm actually calling you from Merida, which is a city 3 hours to the west of Cancun, quite a big expat community down here. I myself am an economic refugee from living in the States for many years. I moved down here 7 years ago. And I wanted to see, I haven't heard you talk about Mexico specifically. I've heard you talk about people moving abroad to escape the problems in the States. And I don't know if you're aware of this, but Mexico is actually the country, after the United States, the most Americans in any one country live in Mexico. So there's a big issue with dollars down here and the dollar relationship to the peso. Can you talk at all about the dollar-peso relationship?
Yeah, I know one of the reasons that a lot of people are down there is a lot of retirees go down there. Because what happens is once you retire, and if you've got a pension or you got Social Security, if you move down south of the border, the cost of living is a lot lower because you've got dollar income, yet you've got peso expenses. And so you can live a much higher quality of life by moving to Mexico as opposed to staying in the United States. That is going to change, because I actually think what's going to happen is when the dollar collapses and you've got a lot of Americans living in Mexico who are relying on dollar-based income streams to support their lifestyle, they're going to be in trouble, because I think the peso is actually going to gain a lot of value against the dollar, and those individuals are going to be in trouble, and they're not going to be able to afford to stay down there in the style that they're down there now. So if anybody is living down there, I think it's important, very important, that you take action to get as much of your wealth as you can out of dollars, not necessarily into pesos, but at least into other sounder currencies so that you have income that's not U.S. dollar-based. Now, a lot of people are living solely off their Social Security money. Those people are going to be in trouble. There's just no way around it. If all you've got is your Social Security and you're spending that down in Mexico, it's going to be very difficult, because there's no way to change that income stream.
Right. Yeah. Well, I've hedged my bets between half my money in pesos in Mexico, half in dollars, and I'm on the verge of opening an account with you to move the dollars out and then keep the peso income to survive down here. I actually moved down here when I was 36, simply because I got out of New York City at the right time, sold an apartment and a house. And the cost of living is so much lower that I was able to retire at that age. But it's a continual eye on the connection between the dollar and the peso. And in the future, if you see any specific advice on that, I'd love to hear that. And as I said, since out of the country, most Americans are living down here, I think you'd have a big audience.
The expats down there that fall into the categories that I've described really need to take some action. And, if you're on the verge of opening up an account, hopefully you actually, do it soon. When you hang up with me, just call up the firm and talk to one of the brokers. And we can help you, get rid of that dollar portfolio and get into, Singapore dollars and euros and, Norwegian krona or Swiss francs and, Canadian dollars and other currency that will help, deliver to you a higher quality of life. Based on the purchasing power of your investment income.
I will definitely do that. One last quick question. I was just very curious, since you're so outspoken and what you're saying is so dramatic in so many ways and on a global scale, do you ever fear for your personal safety, since you're basically up against the government, or am I being a conspiracy theorist?
Every once in a while I have some of those concerns, but what do you do? Look, I mean... There are other people out there that are saying a lot of things, and nothing
right.
necessarily happens to them. I mean, thing is, for all the talk, I mean, I haven't influenced anything. It's not like the government hasn't been able to do what it wanted to do because Peter Schiff was out there.
Right.
So maybe if I was a more credible threat, maybe. But I think it's still a long shot. I mean, I think if something's going to happen to me, it's probably more likely going to be just a random accident, although I'm sure if there was an accident and something happened to me, I'm sure there'd be plenty of people on the Internet that had all kinds of conspiracy theories as to how I met my demise.
I've watched too many movies. Well, thank you very much for your time, Peter, and any comments in the future on Mexico in particular would be greatly welcomed, and thank you very much, and you're doing a great job. Thank
all
you.
Right, thanks, John. Bye-bye. Next call is Matt from Boston. Go ahead, Matt.
Hey, Peter, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Pretty good. I have a quick comment about FINRA and all these financial regulations I think you find pretty interesting. First of all, I read both your books, and I've already pre-ordered Freshman 2.0 on Amazon, and I'm pretty excited to read that when it comes out.
I'm having a hard time hearing you.
A little background on myself. I work for a large conservative private bank, and recently had an issue with my company's compliance department when I tried unsuccessfully to open up an account on Europac. Apparently, compliance told me in an email that in order to meet industry standards and FINRA regulations and to reduce compliance risk, employees are only allowed to open up accounts from six specific designated brokers. And, you know, I bet you know which six those were. They were TD Ameritrade, E-Trade, you know, all the ones that got bailed out by the government. I found out that these new rules were put into place at my company at the end of October of last year, and which is, you know, right during the height of the crash. And Europac is a certified FINRA member, so I don't know what the deal is with me not being allowed to sign up with you, but I just thought I'd mention this.
Where do you work? Are you allowed to say where you work?
Yeah, I work for, it's called Brown Brothers and Harriman. You might know them. They're in New York. They're in Boston. It's a large private bank up here.
Right, but so they're also a FINRA member.
Yeah, definitely. Yep,
yeah, so that's why. I mean, basically, if you didn't work for another FINRA, see, here's the problem, right? When you work for a registered firm, right, if you open up an account with another brokerage firm, the rules, FINRA rules, require duplicate statements and that you keep track of it. And so what the company is probably trying to do is saying, look, we don't want to have to look at all kinds of weird statements from all kinds of firms we've never heard of. They want to keep it simple. And so they're doing that because they're required by FINRA to get copies of all your statements and look at what you're doing. And so maybe they thought, well, we're just going to limit it to these, you know, five or six different firms so that we don't have all different types of statements coming in and all different, you know. But if you worked at a non-FINRA firm, that type of restriction wouldn't be there. But, you know, there's always, you know, you always have to jump to extremes. I mean, for example, you know, I've got these, I'm being audited right now this week, and they're in there. They've been there for 4 or 5 weeks. There's five guys auditing me all week, you know. And, of course, you know, too bad they couldn't, you know, they couldn't have audited Bernie Madoff and actually found his scam. If they'd have spent as much time at Madoff's shop as they are at mine, maybe they would have figured it out. But, you know, one of the things they're spending a lot of time auditing is instant messaging, you know, and, you know, they're looking at every damn instant message that all my brokers send to each other. And, of course, I have to spend a lot of money. I actually have to save every single instant message in my company. Now, the reason that this rule came into effect was because there were some instant IMs with some research departments at Merrill Lynch during the dot-com boom where they were touting stocks and IMing each other about what dogs they were. Now, of course, I didn't do any of that, but because Merrill Lynch did all this bad stuff, now there's a rule requiring me to waste a lot of my own money, you know, keeping track of all these instant messages. But one of the things, the policies I think I'm going to implement in the future is I'm basically going to tell my employees no more instant messages. If you want to communicate on instant message, it can only be something, you know, very quick, like so-and-so called you, here's a phone number, or left, you know. I don't want any substantive communications in these IMs because it just complicates my audits. And so, but it's probably an efficient way to communicate. You know, you have an instant messaging, but now because of government regulations, I say, okay, you know, let's not instant message. You know, I've already banned, you know, we can't, I mean, there's all sorts of things that we've had to stop. And I mentioned that, you know, even my last video blog, I have a lot of growth plans. There's a lot of things that I want to do right now. I mean, I'm in a prime position to expand my business into all sorts of different ways, institutionally, expand retail, my research, investment banking, and all of it has been held up for the last 6 months by FINRA. And, you know, some of it had to do with some, you know, maybe some things that we did wrong, but again, the law, the rules are so complex. I mean, you can innocently, you know, misinterpret one and do something wrong. A lot of it is because it's so slow. I mean, they're so bogged down because they've made everything so complicated. There's so much stuff to do. These guys are so overworked enforcing meaningless regulations and rules that it takes me forever to get their permission to do things that I think I should be able to do without their permission. But meanwhile, I want to hire people. I want to grow my business. And I'm prevented from doing that. And I'm sure I'm not alone. You know, there are probably other firms out there that have growth plans that are being thwarted by government regulation. And the problem is the government wants more regulators now. They want to have a whole new me on top of the ones that are already doing it.
Right.
And meanwhile, none of this regulation is going to make the investors any safer. None of it is going to improve the quality of the investment service or the investment advice that people get. I think to the contrary, it's going to diminish it. It's gonna result in less innovation, in less unique thinking, in fewer firms like mine that are outside the box that are doing a good job, and it's gonna help the very firms that have government TARP money that can afford to comply with all the regulations because the government is giving them the money and they're huge.
So when you plan on coming up to Boston here to do a speech, there's a ton of colleges up here. I'm sure you get a lot of support.
Yeah. Well, I was there. You know, that's where the regulators are. We're regulated from up in Boston, so all the guys that are down in my office now came down from Boston. But, one of these days, although Boston, I mean, I'd like to have an office in Boston, you know, once they give me permission to expand. Although one of the problems is I looked at the employment law in Massachusetts, and I really don't like it. So as a result of some of the laws that have been passed there, I don't think I really want to be an employer in the state of Massachusetts. So for that reason, a Massachusetts Boston office is kind of low on my priority list. But here again, you have the government basically passing laws supposedly to help the employees, but they're so detrimental to the employers that it makes employers not want to come into the state. So instead of helping people, it hurts people because it diminishes the number of employers, so it diminishes the employment opportunities for people living in Boston and for the entire state. But anyway, thanks for the call.
Yep.
Okay, next up is David in Pompano Beach, Florida.
Hi, Peter. I was hoping you could talk about how to go about investing my partner's life insurance proceeds to help offset the loss of income and for growth long term.
Yeah, well, basically what I would suggest is that you have your partner, you know, call up my company, you know, Euro Pacific Capital. You know, the number is 800-727-7922. And speak with one of the brokers there, and we can get more specific information about your partner and their assets and everything else, and try to, you know, make some recommendations.
Let me back up. He passed away, so I'm receiving the
Then the advice is for you to try to, you know, for you, yes, to call up and figure out, you know, what's best suited for you. But again, what I think is the principal risk facing investors and savers is the risk to the purchasing power of the currency they're saving and investing, meaning the U.S. dollar. The real cost of all the stimulus and bailouts is going to be borne through a decline in the value of the dollar. Ultimately, that's what's going to happen. Unfortunately, the crisis is going to end up as a currency crisis, and people are going to lose a fortune. You know, the government is right now trying to prevent everybody from losing money. They're trying to prevent banks from failing. They're trying to prevent insurance companies from failing because they don't want Americans to lose their money that they have on deposit in these institutions. Well, instead of losing their money is going to lose its value because there is no magic elixir. Real money has been lost. Trillions of dollars have been squandered in this country, and the losses have to be there. There's no way the government can paper them over with a printing press. If they print money, the losses are still going to be there. You just won't see it in a nominal sense. You'll just feel it when you try to spend your money. So you have to understand that inflation, that is the predominant risk that you face. And you have to throw away all the conventional wisdom on what investments are safe and what investments are prudent, because those rule books were written for a sound dollar. The minute you think the dollar is unsound, then you got to toss those rule books out the window because none of them will apply. And you've got to adopt an investment strategy given today's circumstances. And we can help you do that.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Peter.
Thank you, and sorry for your loss.
Thank you.
Next up is Henry in Baltimore.
Hello, Mr. Schiff.
Yes.
My question has to do with Austrian economics. I've been reading books by Ludwig von Mises and Murray Rothbard, and one of the things they talk about is how mathematical equations have no role in proving or verifying economic theories. And I know that economics is different entirely from speculation, but I'm trying to learn about economics in order to become a better speculator, mm-hmm. And so they are related.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of mathematics in economics, at least, you know, the way they teach it at the universities. And where it made sense to me that you could use it and you can see it had to do with microeconomics, and where you can express demand curves and supply curves with algebraic formulas. And, you know, you can express marginal cost as the derivative of this or that. And there's some ways that it really works mathematically, and it helps you really to grasp what's going on a micro level. Where I don't think the economics should play a part, and where it still does is in this phony science of macroeconomics. And I think macroeconomics is basically all Keynesianism, and it's all nonsense. Microeconomics, you know, makes sense, and mathematics have a part there in really being able to figure things out. But I think the overall economy, it works based on the fundamental laws of economics that I think are expressed by people like Mises without having to use economics, without having to try to express it in some kind of, you know, algebraic or calculus type equation.
Yeah, and in fact, Mises shows in Human Action that math cannot possibly contribute to the economic theory.
Mm-hmm.
And a basic understanding of economics.
I'm
wondering along those lines.
Math, if you can express demand and supply curves mathematically, and you can show, you know, you can look at how marginal costs work and how businesses, you know, how you would construct a demand and supply curve based on, you know, production costs and other factors, and you can express it mathematically, which I think is good. But beyond that, as far as trying to, you know, make predictions about, you know, how introducing more government spending in the economy is going to grow aggregate demand. I mean, I think that's a bunch of nonsense, and I don't care what type of mathematical formulas you're trying to use to justify some kind of phony, you know, money multiplier. It's not going to work.
Do you think some of the really successful quantitative hedge funds like Renaissance Technologies might run into a lot of trouble when their mathematical arbitrage calculations that they're doing in a high volume that make a lot of money in neutral markets suddenly fail when, you know, something unexpected and fundamental happens?
Yeah, well, a lot of what those guys are doing is they're making investments based on models. And the models are only as good as the data that they supply the models from which to extrapolate, future trends and to tell, you know, what's probable and what's improbable. But a lot of the models, of course, are wrong. I mean, one of the problems with, let's say, the assumptions made in the real estate market is they plugged into the model that real estate prices always go up. Well, if your model assumes real estate prices always go up, then, you know, a lot of things are possible. But in the real world, you know, real estate prices don't always go up, despite the fact that they had always gone up in the past. And so the models were programmed based on that phony assumption.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I mean, I was able to make a lot of very accurate predictions about the economy, and I didn't use math at all.
And so did Mises.
Meanwhile, you had a lot of mathematicians or you had a lot of mainstream economists that had their fingers on calculators, and they were doing all kinds of stuff, and they were totally clueless about what was going to happen.
But what's needed the most, I think, nowadays is for someone to be really successful and to also hold Austrian views. There are a few of them. Like on TV, we see Mark Faber and Jim Rogers. But if someone like Soros,
I spoke with him at a conference. I mean, he's extremely successful in his hedge fund, and he made a lot of money based on his views, and you know, now he's making big bets on gold, and he's looking for hyperinflation. So there, I mean, I've been successful. I mean, I'm not successful to the point that I've made billions, but you know, I might, you know, over the next five years or so. But I've done very, very well. And I, you know, investing from an Austrian perspective, and, you know, I did have clients in a hedge fund that did exactly what, those guys did, that did exactly what, Paulson did, and, you know, we did short subprime market, and we were able to use those Austrian principles to identify those opportunities. I wasn't able to parlay it into $1 billion. I didn't have the resources at my disposal that these guys had. But we did pretty well.
Yeah, I mean, for better or for worse, most people tend to want to learn from someone who is actually predicting successfully, even though that's different from doing economics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there's not that many wealthy economists. The vast majority of economists don't have a lot of money. And you would think, well, gee, if these economists were so smart, why aren't they all rich? And the reality is most of them are not that smart, or at least if they're smart, they're not right. With respect to economics, and of course it makes sense that they're not right because, you know, it's garbage in, garbage out. I mean, they've learned Keynesianism, and they think they know economics. They don't know anything.
Yeah, and there's a tendency
like, for... A guy goes to medical school, and he thinks he's going to learn medicine, but he learns voodoo from a witch doctor. And then he graduates, and he thinks he's a doctor. But he's not. He didn't learn any real medicine. He learned quackery. And that's basically what Keynesianism is. And unfortunately, that's what everybody in this country has embraced. The entire concept of the stimulus is based on Keynes. You know, the whole idea of running deficits and priming the pump and stimulating aggregate demand, this is all Keynesian nonsense. And that's exactly what George Bush did, you know, when he inherited a recession. He resorted to Keynes and gave us the housing bubble, gave us, you know, this gigantic financial collapse. There's no real thing, but yet they're doing the same mistakes over again.
I agree. Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Next up is Henry. Oh, no, I just lost. Next up is Eric in Charlotte, North Carolina.
Hey, Peter, I appreciate you taking my call. I just wanted to take a second and kind of thank you in a way that you probably don't hear very often. I read your book, Crash Proof, back in February 2007, which was the first month that it came out. And at the time, I was in the process of putting an offer on a townhome in Virginia. And your book, I mean, basically your chapter on real estate shook me up with your understanding so clearly of what was happening in real estate. And I walked away from the deal. And that townhome right now is probably selling for somewhere below $125,000 back when I was trying to buy it for $200,000. I'm a young person in my 20s, so that would have just essentially destroyed my life financially. And I've given your book over the last, you know, two and a half years to probably 20 people. And a large number of those people, younger people, have walked away from real estate and done the same thing. And all those people would have been destroyed at the end of the market. So I know you don't hear that very often. I just want to say thank you for that. And your ability
to
see what's
going on. Yeah, I really appreciate that. And two, a lot of people don't see that. When people, you know, people don't see the money that I save people who
right.
have read my book and either did not buy real estate when they were thinking about buying real estate or who turned around and sold real estate. There are people that I've talked to that told me that they sold their home specifically based on reading my book. And if
right.
anybody sold their home anytime in 2007, they're way better off than the people who still have their homes.
Exactly.
And I definitely laid out, I mean, it was just one chapter. In fact, when I was first writing that book, I thought about writing an entire book on the housing bubble and the coming housing collapse, but I wanted to get a broader book out, so I decided to condense it into one single chapter. But I think that chapter did enough. I didn't think I needed a whole book. I think I could basically say it in a chapter, and well, I did, but I thought it was big. A lot of the books that have come out since the collapse that were specifically focused on the real estate bubble and bursting, I could have written 300-400 pages, and I could have laid it out in detail exactly what was going on back then because I had it all in my head. But I just didn't, I only wanted to write the one book, and so I had to condense it into a chapter.
Sure. Well, I appreciate that. And you mentioned Noriel Rubini at the beginning of the show as someone who has a good understanding of what's going on. He kind of differs from your views a little bit, kind of here and there. And I think the economists out there that understand what's going on have basically come to a consensus of where we're going in the long term, and that is that, you know, the ultimate destruction of the United States economy, the ultimate destruction of the dollar, and something close to inflation or hyperinflation. And I think from that group, however, there's two kind of smaller groups that are divided within that. And there's a group such as yourself and the Jim Poplava, and
Mark
Haberman
and Jim Rogers. Yeah, I mean, the only thing is there are some people that think it's deflation and then hyperinflation.
Well, that's my question. And, you know, and there's a group like a Bob Precker and a Rubini that you know, ultimately can see the final outcome. But in the short term, their major concern, you know, once again, is that the Fed is essentially pushing on a string with the amount of dollar debt.
Are, but basically, I've come down to this. We all agree on the end game. We
right.
all know how it's going to end up. We just don't know exactly how we're going to get there. And
right.
it's always been my position that since we're investing for the long run, we should position ourselves right now for what we think the end game is going to be, because then we're assured of winning. And
okay.
I tune out the noise in the short run, because no one knows for sure the short run. You can guess. You can make probabilities and think this is the path we're going to take. Nobody knows for sure. I don't know for sure. Nobody knows. I'm just making my best guess based on what I know. But what I do know for sure, at least in my mind, is how it's all going to end, how it's all going to play out. And I'm positioning for that. It's like, I want to win the war. I don't have to win every battle. I just have to win the war. And so
sure.
I'm trying to position my clients to win the war.
Sure.
Some
well,
people
yeah,
think
I mean,
you have to win every battle, you know.
Right.
I don't.
Well, I think in either scenario, and I think what the deflationists get it wrong, is that even in the short term, based on what's happening, the dollar itself is likely to fall. Whether even
yes,
if we have an actual contraction of the money supply, the dollar itself is what's going to cause your investments.
Yep.
Is what's going to cause.
Hey, anyway, I don't need to cut you short, but I got 10 minutes left. I realize I got a full board still left. So thanks for the call, Eric. I appreciate it.
Have a good night.
Okay, let's have no more calls. I want to try to quickly take. I got three people still on hold. I want to quickly try to get through them in the last 10 minutes. George in Bristol, PA. Go ahead, George.
How you doing, Pete?
Good. How are you?
How are you doing? Okay. I want to run this by you, then I'll hang up and listen. A lot of people have been talking about Obama's confidence in Bernanke lately, and I was wondering if you think that he might be doing this to pass his changes in the Fed, and then after he gets his changes done, replace Bernanke with some extremists. And I'll listen. Okay.
Bernanke is pretty extreme as far as I'm concerned. Yeah, I've heard that praise. It's all nonsense. He basically, Obama said that he can't imagine how anybody could have done a better job than Ben Bernanke. Well, he doesn't have much of an imagination. I mean, you couldn't have done a worse job than Ben Bernanke. I mean, it would have been pretty hard to have done a worse job. But I think he has to talk about how great he is because he wants to try to instill confidence in all the people that we're borrowing money from. And so he wants to talk up the qualifications of Bernanke, particularly if he ends up reappointing him, which he probably will do. I think the only way he won't reappoint Bernanke is if there's some major catastrophe between now and the time he's reappointed, in which case they might try to rearrange the deck chairs and go with somebody else. But I think as long as nothing bad is happening, he's not going to want to upset the apple cart. And, you know, for a lot of people, it's always the devil they know. And, you know, and he is a devil, and we do know him, but, you know, they might think that it's better than another one. Anyway, let me take the next call is David in New York. Go ahead, David. David, are you there? Hello, David. Well, I'm not hearing David. Let's go to Sam in Wyoming. Is Sam there?
Yes, I'm here.
Go ahead. You're on the air.
Mr. Schiff, I've always had this idea that the best currency is actually energy itself. You could even back a paper currency with energy, like making a dollar worth 100 kilowatts or 100,000 BTUs or something like that.
Yeah.
And
well, I think it kind of overcomplicates the situation. And, you know, you have to remember there's a difference between currency and money. Okay, what we want at the basis of our monetary system is actual money. And I think that gold serves as money much easier than, you know, BTU units. So I think
maybe,
that,
but,
you know, we don't have to constantly reinvent the wheel, right? Gold works as money. Markets have constantly voted for gold as money. Our founding fathers were very smart people, and they set us on a gold standard. They made the dollar gold. And they did that for a reason. And what I think we need is we need a return to a real monetary system where money is at the core. We can still have currency, provided that it's backed by money, because that's what gives currency value, the fact that there's money backing it up. The problem now is we have currency with nothing backing it up. And so we just have pieces of paper that Ben Bernanke can run off the printing presses, you know, whenever he wants. And that is detrimental to society. It's detrimental to economic growth. It's undermining our prosperity. The government is robbing us of the benefits of sound money and the rising living standard that sound money and capitalism produce. Because sound money and capitalism lead to falling prices, what the government now thinks is the scourge of deflation. We want prices to fall. Because prices falling means the cost of living goes down, which means we're all better off, which means we can buy more for less money. We live better. We have better lives. That is what we're entitled to as Americans, and the government is robbing us of our heritage and the benefits of the free market economy that our founding fathers had the wisdom to enshrine in our Constitution. And what we need to do is try to go back to that. We need to abandon all the socialist doctrines that everybody has embraced and go back to the market, the free market principles upon which our country was founded.
I understand that, but in the end, the bottom line is that gold has no base value compared to...
Gold has value. Gold has intrinsic value. It's paper money that has no intrinsic value. Gold has a lot of very unique properties that makes it highly valuable. I mean, it, you know, it has a lot of uses, and it's real. And the key about gold, too, is that it's scarce. It's hard to come by. You know, money needs to be scarce. You can't have money falling from the trees. You know, then it won't be worth anything. And so gold has a lot of very unique and interesting properties that other metals don't have. And it's been desired for thousands of years for its intrinsic value. That's what makes it so ideally suited to be money. Because all money does is it eliminates the requirement to barter. And so what happens is under a barter system, if I'm a chair maker and I want a table, I got to find a table maker who wants my chairs. It's very cumbersome. But if we can agree on a commodity that everybody will exchange for everything else, then the economy is a lot more efficient. So if I sell my chairs for gold, I know that I can take my gold and give it to anybody because everybody will accept gold. But not everybody wants my chairs. You know, so it makes it run efficiently. But the minute you say, well, let's make it all work with paper, well, that's fine in theory. And in theory, paper money could work. The problem was, in practice, it can never work because the politicians can't be trusted not to print it because they will. It's impossible. There's never been a politician who's got their hands on a printing press who didn't use it.
I agree, except for to a starving man, an ounce of gold has no value compared to a loaf of bread.
Well, so when it comes to actual
barter...
If you were stranded on a desert island, right, and there was nobody around, yes, I would rather have bread than gold. But in the real world, if you have gold, you can always buy bread. And the problem is that if you try to save your bread, it can go stale. Gold will not go stale. You can put your gold away, and 100 years from now, you can buy bread with it. But I wouldn't want to eat 100-year-old bread.
In my instance, though, all life depends on energy, and there's a base value for energy that it'll never go below because once it goes down, you can produce, you can bake more bread, you can drive further.
Yeah, I understand where you're going, but I still think it's really complicated to try to reinvent the monetary system based on energy units. You know, if we just go back to the money that we know works, it's a lot less complicated than that. But yeah, in theory, what you're trying to do is say we need money that has some value, which I agree. Paper, the problem is what we have right now has no intrinsic value whatsoever. And that is the source of our problems because the politicians can keep printing it and printing it and printing it so they can pretend that they're Santa Claus. So they can try to give the voters government that they don't have to pay for through taxes. They pay for it through inflation instead. They just don't understand it. Anyway, thanks for the call. I know we're running out of time, so I appreciate the call.
Thank you.
Anyway, just got a couple of minutes left. These hours always go by very quickly. So, you know, in the meantime, don't forget to, you know, visit the website at www.europac.net. If you haven't gotten Crash Proof, you know, you can still read it, although Crash Proof 2.0 is finished. The book will be out. In fact, you can already order it on Amazon. I've seen the cover looks pretty cool. I think it's a lot more eye-catching than the original cover. So hopefully we'll have a lot of sales. And hopefully the book will stand out now because, again, when it first came out, there were hardly any books about an economic collapse. Now they're all over the place. So hopefully it will be able to stand out in a very crowded crowded shelves of economic gloom and doom type books. Also, I did sign a deal. I have another book that's coming out, and a lot of people have asked me about my father's books, how to get a hold of his books, how an economy grows and why it doesn't, or The Kingdom of Malts. And I signed a contract with Wiley. The book will be out probably early next year, but I am going to redo and update those stories, re-illustrate them, and come out with a brand new book. And it's basically a cartoon book that really explains economics and the gold standard in a way that's very understandable and very entertaining. So I'm excited about those books, and certainly when it comes out, make sure to get those. Anyway, that's it for today. Anyway, thanks everybody again for listening. Don't forget the toll-free number, 800-727-7922. Make sure and call. If you don't have an account, open one up. Send us your dollars so we can reinvest them in something before it's too late, before the bottom drops out of the dollar, and it's too late to preserve your wealth because it's gone out from under you. Anyway, again, it's 800-727-7922. Thanks again, everybody, for listening. This is Peter Schiff for Wall Street Unspun and Euro Pacific Capital. Good night, everybody.